There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern and I am joined by Heidi White and our very special guest, Karen Swallow Pryor. Karen, Heidi, welcome back to the show.
Hello.
Thanks, David.
So, Karen, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Did your family that was in town actually leave you alone while you were recording last week?
Yes, they did. And I still have some family here. And I just called them and said, don't forget, I'm recording a podcast. So, anyway.
Do they know what podcasts are?
That I don't know.
They've been around for a while now, and I've been doing this for a long time, and I still get people who say, wait, a what now? But, you know, we're in the business of education, so.
That's right.
We are here to discuss Sense and Sensibility. We are going to be discussing Volume 1, Chapters 9 through 15. So that section ends with the chapter where Willoughby departs and Eleanor and Mrs. Dashwood debate the whole situation. So that's where the section ends, and we will be finishing Volume 1 next week. So just for everyone getting their bearings. Before we dive into the conversation, though, I just want to remind you about our friends over at Classical Academic Press and their Classical U program. If you are a busy school or homeschool educator who is, you know, despite being busy, enthusiastic about the classical tradition of education, maybe you wish you'd been classically trained, well, then Classical U was created with you in mind. They're confident that this resource will inspire educators in schools, homeschools, co-ops, all kinds of different settings to dig deep into the richness of learning, no matter where you find yourself on your journey in classical education. Discover over 35 self-paced courses. They have regularly added content all the time, and they have various forms of community, including forums. And then they also have recently added accreditation through ACSI. You can begin your journey at classicalu.com, and Close Reads listeners can try Classical U free through June 29th. All you got to do is visit classicalu.com/code, C-O-D-E, and then enter the code CERCEPODCAST at checkout, and you'll get access through June 29th. So thanks to Chris Perrin and the whole team at Classical Academic Press for sponsoring Close Reads the last couple months, and I hope you'll check out their program. We've got some lectures up on there as well that you can check out. Okay, Sense and Sensibility. We talked a lot, well, maybe not a lot, I don't know. We talked last week about the idea of this book being a comedy of manners, about the satire going into it. So I was thinking, as I was reading, of course, about that. And I started thinking about whether we're supposed to see all the characters as being satirized. So I was thinking, for example, about the differences in these chapters between Eleanor and Marianne, between Mrs. Dashwood and Mrs. Jennings. There's all these different characters that have sort of different registers about them. They have different tones. So Karen, I want to ask you this. Do you think that we are supposed to see, we call this a satirical novel. So do you think we're supposed to read all the characters at the same level of satire? Does that question make sense?
No, that's a great question. And I think this is one of the most challenging aspects of reading Austen. It varies in her novels, but this one is particularly challenging in that respect because there are many different satirical voices. It's not just,
right, yeah.
You know, if you say the greatest example of English satire, Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, right? Where he proposes that the Irish raise children to be eaten by the English in order to survive. There's like, it's great satire, but there's one satirical voice. There's one persona that is making this proposal ironically. But in Austen, you know, she slips in and out of different levels of satire and earnestness. And it shifts, and you really have to constantly be on your guard to sort of hear the tone that you're supposed to read each part with.
I was reading that chapter 15, that episode in chapter 15 with this question in mind in particular, because I was thinking about the way Eleanor was responding to Marianne and Willoughby's relationship, to the way Margaret treats the relationship, to the way her mother responds to it. Mm-hmm. And there's, and you can, in some areas or in some characters, some scenes, some moments, you can see the satire more clearly. You can tell that Austen's trying to actively be satirical. And then in Eleanor, sometimes you, it's easy to agree with the way she responds, you know, her sort of reserved nature, her discretion, all those sort of things that she values are things that we value as readers. Well, ostensibly, but then it's hard to know, well, is her response also being satirized? Is her discretion, is her sort of, prudence, I guess mm-hmm. it would be the word, is that also being satirized? How do you read Eleanor? I want to go ask you that, and then I want to hear what how Karen responds to that.
How I read Eleanor?
Yeah, in these particularly in these chapters, and particularly in the way that she responds to Marianne and Willoughby's relationship, like the sort of what we're right. supposed to read as a sort of prudence or wisdom, I guess.
Right, that she like. Has some caution and some reserve. Now, yeah, the readers. Yeah. Even at this point in the novel, if this is the first time reading the novel, we don't know what happens with Willoughby yet. And right. so the only clue we really have that there's some potential trouble spots is Eleanor's reaction. In every other way, Willoughby is a paragon so far in the story. And everything that Marianne has been looking for, and he's just delightful to the family. And
by so far, you mean up until the point when he basically leaves?
Yes. Yes, yeah, okay. exactly. Yeah. Up to the point that we have read, the only indication yeah. that we have that something might be a little off is the fact that he's just left and we don't know why, which could have been, I mean, Brandon has also left. So
there's,
and then we also know that Eleanor has some kind of internal sensor going off about maybe there's something not quite right here. She has no concrete evidence that Marianne and Willoughby are engaged, which of course within this society, Marianne's behavior would have been very improper and so would Willoughby's if they were not. But if they had some kind of secret engagement, which everybody else is assuming because Willoughby seems so wonderful. So I think the fact that Eleanor is so cautious and prudent, not yet in the novel do we know whether or not that's necessary or whether or not she's being overly cautious and overly, you know, just suspicious, which is what some people suspect of her.
Suspicious, yeah.
Yeah, that maybe she's, you know, overreacting. But her good sense is so obvious that all kind of discerning readers who are paying attention have their radar up at this point.
The novel certainly seems to be suggesting that she's meant to be trustworthy.
Right. Yes.
So would you agree with that, Karen?
Yes, absolutely. And I would just say that even as we, you know, for people who are reading it for the first time, don't know how things turn out with Willoughby, we also don't know how things turn out with Eleanor and the corrections she needs and the lessons she learns. I mean, even at the end of chapter 15 in one of her final quotes, she says, I love Willoughby, sincerely love him, and suspicion of his integrity cannot be more painful to yourself than to me. So she's acknowledging it, but as Heidi said, we know something is amiss, yet even Eleanor can't quite see it. And she also falls for Willoughby in the sense of believing his character and liking him and hoping for the best. And so we kind of, as readers, make some of the same mistakes that even the most reliable character in the novel makes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That gets me thinking about, so is the book, do you think, is Jane Austen trying to sort of like in a crime fiction novel or something, do you think she's trying to misdirect the readers about some of these characters?
I think that's a really good question. Yep. Go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, no, I was going to say absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's more obvious. Sorry to keep bringing up Pride and Prejudice, but it's like one of the, if you can get Pride and Prejudice, I think it's easier to get all of the other Austen novels. But with Elizabeth Bennet, we're supposed to, she's an even more extreme version of Eleanor. She's even more likable. We're supposed to really identify with Elizabeth because she's so wonderful in just about every way. And yet we get tricked into thinking like Elizabeth, that her perspective and her, her psychological insight is reliable. And then we find out that it's not. So I think this is one of Austen's great arts is this kind of misdirection, as you put it.
Mm. Right. She succeeds at that, I think, very well. And as Karen pointed out, other satirical novelists who are, I mean, great. Like she said, Jonathan Swift is considered the greatest satirical novel. That particular that's not really a novel. It's an essay, right?
Right.
Yes. So, but there is this one voice with Jonathan Swift, but with Austen, you're slipping in and out of the, you know, some of these characters are taking completely seriously, completely at face value, whether or not they're foolish and to be judged the entire novel, or whether or not they're steady and consistent and to be highly esteemed. And then there's those characters in the middle that we see a lot of reversals in. And that's particularly true in this novel. And that's one of the reasons why, even though, as we kind of pointed out last week, some of the writing, Jane Austen's still kind of finding her voice here, but the reversals that we have in the characters in this novel, I think, are just brilliant. And we're starting to see a little bit of that at this point, although that definitely takes place later as we go. But we have made judgments about these characters so far, whether or not they're, quote, good or bad or foolish or silly, or whether we're judging them and making fun of them, or whether or not we're taking them seriously. And as the novel progresses, there's some reversals that take place, and that, I think, is part of Jane Austen's brilliance in writing satire. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that those reversals are due to, I mean, say the ones, well, can you give me an example, for the sake of conversation, of a reversal that you're seeing begin to take place here in these first chapters? Because I have a follow-up question on that.
Sure. Probably at this point, one of the reversals that we're seeing, although it's not that funny, some of them are a little funnier as we go along, is with Mrs. Dashwood and or Eleanor. Because what we have here is Mrs. Dashwood in some ways pitted against Eleanor. They have a different perception of Willoughby right now. And so one of them's going to be wrong. And so depending on our perception of either one of them, there might be a reversal coming up here pretty quickly there. But some of the funnier characters, we're going to get some big reversals on one way or the other as we progress.
I suppose a reversal is a great opportunity for more comedy too.
Right.
But when you're talking about this idea of a reversal, are you talking about a reversal in the way that the character is, or the way that the character is perceived by the reader?
I think perceived. I think perception is what I'm talking about here. Because these characters with a couple of characters, but I think we'll probably dig into that a little more as we go. But we already know some of the characters that we take seriously and some of the, like Eleanor, and Marianne, even though we might see some of their flaws, we also take them seriously. They are the heroines. They are the main character, the protagonists. We're rooting for them. Whereas some of these side characters like Mrs. Jennings, they're funny characters. We're kind of making fun of them a little bit, and cheering Austen along as she pokes fun, right? And so some of those characters we're going to see a different perspective on as we go. And I do think it's a matter of perspective. Hmm.
Karen, do you buy this reversal thing that she's talking about here?
No, absolutely I do. I mean, this is one of the things that situates Austen as a neoclassical rather than a romantic writer, because so many of the conventions that we see in her are the classical conventions of comedy. I mean, comedy and tragedy both hinge on reversals. I mean, bigger reversals of fortune or reversals of disruption. And so they're on a smaller scale in Austen, but we clearly see her following some of these classical and neoclassical conventions. And so it's part of, you know, it's part of how satire works, whether it's a reversal in the plot or reversal in our perception of a character or even a character developing. And I would just temper that by saying that often one of the things that Austen nuances about these classical conventions is that it's not always a reversal as much as it is a moderation. We get that in the title too. You know, we have these two extreme Sense and Sensibility, and, you know, without giving too much away, you know, we're going to see them moderate by the end. And so that's a lot of what Austen does, is moderate or temper our misperceptions or our excesses or our, you know, judgments.
And it seems like in some ways she's trying, early in this novel at least, she's trying to, she's giving us all these different scenes and characters who may or may not have excess or lack in those areas. And she's kind of drawing, she's kind of putting people on one side or the other of some sort of medium, like center. And part of the way that the part of the plot of the novel is helping us kind of bring us to see where different people are on that side of that center line, so to speak, that she ends up trying to draw you back to. I really like that idea that she's not necessarily trying to flip people around completely, but bring them towards a center.
Right.
That's really interesting. Is that, do you see that? And is that just classic Jane Austen, or is that, you think that's something specific to this novel?
Well, I think it's classic Jane Austen. I think it's actually a little bit more obvious in this, her early, you know, her earliest, one of her earliest works.
Like it lacks subtlety?
What?
Do you mean that it lacks subtlety?
Yeah, right, right. It's just, yeah, and even the even the title itself, Sense and Sensibility, are these two extremes as understood in their usage at that time. And this is, you know, this is Alistair MacIntyre in his book After Virtue. He talks about Austen as one of the last writers of virtue. And that's, you know, that's really the classical definition of virtue, is the moderation between an extreme of an excess and an extreme of deficiency. And so I do think this is what Austen basically does in all of her works.
So do you think that by this point in the book, she has kind of clearly drawn the lines as far as these characters? Like, it seems like we're supposed to assume at this point that Marianne has an excess, but has she gotten to the point yet? Do you think that Eleanor is supposed to, or whoever is supposed to, have an excess or a lacking as well? Or at this point, would you say that Eleanor is sort of more stereotypically our heroine here? Either one of you can answer that, actually. You can just jump in, talk over each other.
Well, I think that one thing that this novel excels at greatly is kind of becoming a mirror of the reader's own perceptions of one or the other, right? If you are Team Marianne, you are rooting for Willoughby right now. You are really wanting this thing to turn out well. You're so excited that she has found this man who meets all of her ideals, and you're like, I'm glad you're being honest, like, good job going upstairs and crying and being sad and fully owning your emotions in this repressed society, right? Like, and then, but on the other hand, there's also, if you're Team Eleanor, if you're Team Sense, you're seeing something else going on, right? And so I think that this particular novel does, especially among women, a remarkable job of mirroring our own kind of way in which we emotionally engage with the world. And one of the reversals that happens in this novel is in the reader, as you go through the course of the novel and experience this story and how that kind of pulls out your own prejudices one way or the other and helps moderate them within the reader. And, but not in a way that's like a Aesop's Fables kind of like, judgmental, moralizing kind of way. It just kind of draws you into the story and you respond to it.
There's not a moral at the end of every chapter.
Right. And there's definitely, as Karen's saying, there definitely is a cautionary tale. There is a moral to this story. There is a call to virtue embedded within the story, but it is a great novel. And so it's not written to say, hey, you should be more like Eleanor. Wow, Eleanor, you just really need a Marianne to kind of draw out the heart inside of you, you cold hearted. You know what I mean? Like that's not the point, but it is an exploration. And I think this novel particularly excels at drawing the reader into the conflict and resolution and harmony and dissonance between those two different things in how we react and respond to what's going on in the novel. And I think we already see that at this point by chapter 15.
Yeah, and if I can just pick up on the way that a good novel teaches, as opposed to Aesop's fables or a sermon. Not that there's anything wrong with those things,
right?
Sure, yeah.
But one of the things that I love that Austin does, and this happens a lot in this novel, is rather than having the narrator narrate everything, so many of the things that we learn about happening come through characters who have eavesdropped or who have seen something that seems like it could be only interpreted only one way. It's a very clear thing. Mm. And then they retell what they have overheard or what they saw or what they understood. And so, I mean, that's also another way that Austin achieves misdirection, but it's also a way that replicates real life, because so much of what we experience and learn and think is not through direct experience, but through what we hear other people say or report. It's really brilliant. And that happens, that's already happened here with especially the most humorous examples that occur side by side are Margaret Eleanor about the lock of hair that Willoughby took from Marianne. And then she turns right around and tells everybody about, Eleanor's in love with a man whose name begins with F. so all of these stories, it's a world built by discourse, by stories. And ours is the same way. We just have Twitter now telling us, shaping our perceptions, sadly. So that's another thing, the way that Austin replicates real life in such a way that we can experience it and learn from it indirectly rather than having the moral told to us.
Is that part of the comedy of manners factor? I mean, is that part of that tradition?
That's a good question. I mean, a true comedy of manners is a drama. And so that's very, portrayed in directly. So I don't think so. I think this is something maybe that's part of Austin's particular craft and style.
Would it have been uncommon in her time?
This is, I think I talked about this a little bit last time, but I think what tended, this is Austin's great contribution to the art of the novel, is I think that you had novels that were told either in first person, like through a diary or through letters, and like just kind of very earnest and sincere and like, blah, here's my whole self all over the page. Or you would have a very distant kind of third person narrator. And what Austin does is she mixes them. You get a combination, and it's very subtle and nuanced and artful. And so she's kind of drawn from the extremes of the previous traditions and moderated them again. That's her brilliance in writing novels.
And I suppose the degree to which she relies upon the dialogue and the eavesdropping helps enhance that, all the different voices that she's presenting and all the different perspectives and things like that.
Yes.
She couldn't have done that without that.
Exactly. And another way to, I was thinking about this as I was rereading it and thinking about people who might be reading it for the first time and thinking about the irony. This is very, very basic, but it's just really helpful to pay attention to what appears in quotation marks, because that comes from a character, and then what is narrated indirectly by the narrator through perhaps another character's voice. It can be so hard to keep track of. But again, just paying attention to reported speech and then paying attention to what's narrated, and knowing that what's narrated is what we have to figure out. Oh, how are we supposed to take this? If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I was struck that there were even, well, to me anyway, it seemed like there were pages where maybe there'd be a series of, maybe there'd be two pages of primarily dialogue, and then you'd get some kind of reflection about the dialogue, which was clearly meant to be in one of the participants' voice or in their head. Mm-hmm. But then the next paragraph after that almost seems like it's another level of distance, maybe it's, you know, a little more omniscient, where it starts talking about the weather or something, you know, something else is going on. So on the same page, you seem like you could have three or four different perspectives all kind of coming at you at the same time. And that, if you're not reading closely, then it can create sort of a dissonance. It can be distracting even. And one of the things I was thinking about is the way her writing, I was having to catch myself, because her writing is so, there's a lot of energy to it, you know, especially for maybe something of that period. And there's, you know, the dialogue is very snappy in some ways. I find myself reading very quickly. And then all of a sudden I'd realize, okay, now I'm not really sure whose head I'm in. And if you're not, it kind of almost forces you to slow down and be a little more careful with it. Because if you're not careful, she can kind of just whisk you away. And then all of a sudden you're, I don't want to say confused, but you've been caught up in it. And maybe that's part of the art. Maybe that's part of the artistry that gets you caught up in it. And so then you start questioning whose head you're actually in and whose perspective is the right one. Mm-hmm. Maybe that disorientation is part of the point.
Right. Right. I think that you're onto something with that, David. And I think you have to pay attention to Austin's writing, because as you've both said, she switches perspectives so often that you have to be following along. And then it's just so funny. You don't want to miss anything, especially with the dialogue, as Karen's pointing out. When a character is speaking, sometimes we take it at face value. Sometimes it's just hilariously ironic and really fun to try to figure out. You know, I'm thinking specifically of Mrs. Jennings, how funny she is to read. And I think so much of Austin is just the pure delight of these ordinary kind of quotidian moments that the first time you're reading the novel, you want to get to who marries whom and how do they get there and all that. But just slow down and pace yourself and read along, because the novel is very quotidian. It's very ordinary. And there's just so much humor embedded within the dialogue and in these characters.
Yeah, there's a lot of walking in the rain.
Yeah, there is a lot of walking in the rain. That is true.
Well, I mean, I guess it is a novel about England, so
that's true.
Sorry, Karen, go ahead.
No, and I was, you know, I was thinking about because normally when the semester ends, I'll often just want to read something by Thomas Hardy or something. And I was thinking about what is the difference by this experience. And I was thinking, you know, Thomas Hardy, right, and a lot of others, that's just my easiest example. Those are novels to get lost in. And I was thinking about how you don't really get, well, if you do get, you're not supposed to get lost in Austin. You really do have to be kind of like on your guard, and you're sort of outside the world looking in. And for all these reasons that we've been talking about. And so I think that's something that perhaps going into an Austin novel that might be helpful for people to think about. Like, you're not really just getting lost in the world of a univocal narrator. And so it is a different experience.
Right. I think that's insightful, because the narrator herself, Austin, the author, is poking fun at the world. So it's hard to get lost in a world that you're kind of mocking a little bit along the way. But she speaks with great affection for it too. Like she, and so it's not just, you know, this incisive you know, deconstructive kind of commentary on a flawed society. It's kind of the way you talk about your own family, right? When you're like, oh, mom, that's why'd you do that? And you know, it's foolish, but you just love her so much. And so you do have to kind of pay attention to that, as you're saying. I like that idea of you don't really get lost in an Austen world. You have to be on your guard. I think that's really insightful, but you also have a great affection for it too.
Right. I mean, as a satirist, Austen is a Horatian satirist, not a Juvenalian one. Right. She's not angry at the world. She is, offering a mild, amused, loving correction of a world that she's part of. Mm-hmm. You know, she's thinking outside of it, but she's also part of it. And that's what our posture needs to be as well as we read her about her world. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she doesn't seem like she's cynical about it.
Right.
Maybe she is. Maybe that's the wrong word, but it's a little scathing, but it's not cynical.
Right. Right. Right.
Kind of like Heidi mentioned, like if it's your mom or something. And I always think about that concept of, two brothers, they'll fight each other tooth and nail. They'll bloody each other up. But then if someone else jumps in there to fight one of their brothers, they're the first person to defend them. Right. Kind of imagine Jane Austen probably was like also the first person that would have been prepared to defend the culture that she was a part of.
Right.
Because it does seem loving. It does seem like she has affection for the world. And that's why she cares about the virtue, you know, the preservation of virtues or the living out of virtues or however you want to put it.
Right. So even while she's critiquing some of the norms of marriage of her day, she's not trying to deconstruct the institution.
Right.
You know, she's just, it's something very, very different. She sees some of the corrections that need to be made, some of the excesses, but, she's not upsetting the whole apple cart.
Mm. There was a passage that I thought we should spend some time on. Before we do that, I want to ask you about the male characters in this book. Now, I guess it's a little bit of a shifting of gears here. But when you read about Willoughby and, who are all the male characters we've met at this point through chapter 15? Willoughby, obviously, we've met
John Dashwood, Colonel Brandon,
John Dashwood,
mm-hmm. Lord
anybody
Middleton.
Else at this point?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that it so far? Okay. So of those characters, are we supposed to,
and Edward, of course.
Are we supposed to? Yeah. Of course, yeah. Okay. So there's five. That's actually more than I was thinking at this point. Okay, so there's five male characters who we've been presented with. And they all seem pretty different. And the various voices in the novel speak of them in all kinds of different ways. Sometimes respectfully, sometimes, you know, cynically, sometimes very lovingly. They're described in, you know, quite a bit of detail. I think I mentioned last week that there seems to be that passage where they describe Willoughby in sort of like Marianne's ideal type of man. So with all these different descriptions, are we supposed to, do you think, take those descriptions and those ways of looking and thinking about these men as reliable at this point in the novel? Because how else, you know, it's difficult to know exactly how we're supposed to feel about the men in particular, because we're not inside their heads, you know, mm-hmm. So far we haven't been really inside the perspective of any of the men. And so there's all these varying perspectives on someone like Willoughby. And it's hard to know exactly how we are supposed to think about him and to what degree we're supposed to, I don't know.
Right.
I don't want to oversimplify it, but to which we're supposed to trust or like them. Karen, what do you think about the men in the book? I mean, we're not very far into it. So.
Right. That's a really good question because, even though we have the free indirect discourse and the different perspectives, most of the time, at least so far, it is from the female character's perspective, mm-hmm. You know, whether it's Eleanor or Marianne. And so in many respects, and I'm just sort of thinking out loud here because you've asked such a good question I haven't thought about before. In many respects, I think a lot, the men are all other, mm-hmm. You know? And mm-hmm. so, So we almost have to reserve judgment based on the outcome of the plot, I guess. I don't know. I'm thinking about this. Heidi, what do you think?
I completely agree with you. And I can never tell in reading Austen. I'd be really curious to hear both your opinions on this. I can never tell in reading Austen whether or not we don't get behind the eyes of the male characters because it's a plot device in order to kind of keep us guessing for the resolution of the novel. Like if we had as much insight into Willoughby as we do into Marianne or into Edward as we do into Eleanor, we would have no idea, or we would absolutely know what's going to happen.
Right.
I can't always tell if it's that or if it's just that's how men were to Jane Austen, right?
Maybe both.
I think both. And it's funny you say this, David. I was just having a conversation last night with a friend to whom I had introduced John Le Carré after reading. And I said, you've got to read these books. And we're having this exact same conversation about the women of Le Carré. Does he understand women at all?
Yeah.
Right? This is just such a male-dominated society. Are the women portrayed faithfully? Is this, you know, what do we do with these female characters? And I think we have the same question in Austen, which is pretty rare, right? I mean, usually you're behind the eyes of the male characters in a lot of novels, but in Austen, it is, you know exactly what the women are thinking and feeling. And even if you have to get, even if there's irony, even if she's not telling you, you still kind of feel it as you're going. But it's,
You have a sense of it.
Men are just, it always makes me think, are you guys Agatha Christie fans? It makes me think every single time of Miss Marple and how she says in one of her murder mysteries, I'm having my nephew Raymond over for dinner and I have to make sure I have whiskey. And men always require such a lot of meat. That said, she has no idea what to do with a man. Like what these men are like foreign creatures to her. And I think in this, and I can't tell if Austen is doing it kind of on purpose or if that's her own perspective on men. Like, I have no idea what to do with men. So that's, anyway, I'm really curious what you guys think about that.
Well, I do think that it's important that, I mean, we talked about all these different voices that the novel kind of is presented in, but ultimately it seems like by the end of most of her novels, I mean, really, it's about being in the head of one or two specific characters. And you can correct me if we can debate about that. But being in the head of those one or two specific characters, there's, given the nature of the novels, there tends to be one or two specific men who are crucial to the lives of those one or two specific women. And they are those men, part of the whole conflict, the whole point of the novel is the unraveling of the mystery that is those men in order to find a way to have a well-ordered relationship. Like the relationship between the, you know, Darcy and Elizabeth Bennet, like finding harmony in that relationship is about them kind of unraveling the mystery that is the other person. Mm-hmm. And in that case, if we're in Elizabeth's head, and so, you know, we know more about her than we do about him, but he's also trying to unravel the mystery that is her, sort of.
Right.
So that, I think that's a key part of it. I think the Le Carré point is really interesting, actually, because I suspect that John Le Carré would be very happy that you just compared him with Jane Austen. And also in The Little Drummer Girl, main character is a woman.
I haven't read that one yet.
Some people consider it his best book, so you should. But I was thinking a lot while reading this time. I mentioned the crime fiction earlier, I would not be surprised at all if many of the great mystery and spy, you know, the espionage novelists from Graham Greene and Eric Ambler and whoever else, if they were not big Jane Austen fans, because she does reveal things in stages, much like happens in a great spy novel. And even in a lot of crime fiction novels or whatever, sometimes you're only in the head of the detective. So it's kind of, you know, it's like a hard-boiled novel. But then sometimes you're in the head of multiple different characters and the mystery is less, you know, you might know more than the detective does, but how it all comes together is kind of the fun of the novel.
Right.
You know, sometimes those are a little bit more like pop novels, like a Michael Connelly novel or something. But she does unravel things similarly. And so if early spy and crime novelists said they were big Jane Austen fans, well, I guess probably most writers are big Jane Austen fans, but that wouldn't surprise me in terms of the mechanisms of revealing mysteries, especially mysteries about characters.
Right. I think that's really insightful.
I'm rambling.
No, I think that's really interesting. I never thought of that before. I want to go back to one point that you made about Darcy and Elizabeth that I think is important when it comes to the men in Austen. And it is that what we know, even at the end of the novel, what we know about Darcy comes from Darcy. It is self-revelatory. He is saying what he felt and was thinking and why he made certain decisions throughout the course of the novel.
You mean in that final chapter
yes,
at the end?
Yes. And you know, his letter to Elizabeth, even when he's being a jerk, right? His letters to her and what he reveals at the end in that final chapter. And I think that's also true here. The closest I think we get to it is the gentleness with which Austen treats Colonel Brandon in this story. There is just an unfolding of his character throughout this novel, and we're already seeing it, that is different than how she treats Willoughby and Edward. But that there's just this way of seeing how Colonel Brandon's character kind of unfurls throughout the course of the novel, as you pointed out, in stages, in conversations, the good opinion that Eleanor has of him from the very beginning and how she watches him. There's something really lovely about Colonel Brandon. He might be my favorite Austen male character because I think he's so complete, not just as a love object, but as a human.
Where does he stand on your Jane Austen male ranking, Karen?
I will have to think about that. I mean, he's definitely one of my favorites, and that's very interesting and something to watch for, the way that Colonel Brandon's character is developed and revealed, because even later on when we get Willoughby's explanation for his behavior, it's in his words, right? It's his reported speech. And, you know, and then we're left like Eleanor to sort of judge that. It's not narrator really revealing that or developing that character. So
That's a really interesting point that you're alluding to there, that there are times when Austen makes judgments for us, and then there are times when she asks us to make the judgment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
Which, you know, and maybe those are the moments that have the most, the ones where we have to make the decision are the moments that end up having the most, I don't know what, pathos?
Right.
Because we feel it the strongest, or the most strongly.
Right. Well, and I think that in this novel, I mean, maybe in all of Austen, but there's something about this novel in which you can put characters almost in categories, like a satirical character that's being satirized, a character who is fully developed, a character who is an object of love or desire, right? You can put them in these categories, and some of them get reversed and some of them don't. And some of them, I do feel like Austen is telling me how to feel about this certain character. This is a foolish person and you're supposed to judge them. And in some of her other novels, I think, and we keep bringing up Pride and Prejudice specifically, those kind of edges are a little bit more blunted and softened, I think, in which you can come and say, you know, somebody might say, I think Charlotte Lucas did what she had to do. And another reader might say, no, she was a victim the whole time. You know what I mean? But in Sense and Sensibility, there's a little bit of like, by the end of the novel, you've got characters in these categories, and that's perfectly fine. But that's not always the case with Austen, I think.
Right. And I think that's just an earlier work, right, where everything's a little bit starker and clearer. But still, you know, still very well done.
Yes.
Yeah. I mentioned there was a passage that I wanted to touch on. It's really, I kind of wanted to compare two passages, because the reason I asked about the men is because we have these two scenes where they each leave, basically. Mm-hmm. We've got Brandon gets called away under mysterious circumstances. And then what, in the next chapter, two chapters later, Willoughby gets,
he leaves right,
under mysterious circumstances too. We don't know. The one thing they have in common, is that neither of them reveal why they have to leave. Mm-hmm. And they both leave unhappy people in their wake. Mm-hmm. Are there differences though that can help in the ways that they depart that can help us dig into their two characters, do you think?
Oh, that's a good question.
Well, one difference, which may not be what you were thinking of, but it's the first one that occurs to me, is, and this is part of what I talked about earlier, is that when Colonel Brandon leaves after getting a letter, we have Mrs. Jennings, you know, doing all kinds of speculation and actually reporting something that, well, let me not say that yet, but saying, and, you know, giving...
Of course, it is a 200-year-old novel or more, yeah, yeah. So spoilers.
Yeah, reporting something that turns out later to be not quite accurate, you know, that that he has this natural daughter and, oh, this must be why he's leaving. And so his departure ends up, it's like, it, in some regard, it's more dramatic because of what Mrs. Jennings is saying about it and you know, and blowing it up into something that it turns out not to be. Whereas with Willoughby, there's almost like no explanation other than, you know, the normal financial one, I guess, you know, that it's his patroness calling and, you know, he has no choice. I mean, it's more mysterious than that, but it's not surrounded with as much discursive drama, I guess. Mm.
Yeah. But in both cases, people are left sort of trying to create a narrative that could make sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like they're trying to look at all these different clues and try to figure it out. And Mrs. Jennings fashions, you know, she thinks she's a little, you know, she thinks she's Miss Marple or Jewel Pro or whatever. She's got all these clues and things she thinks she knows, and she's going to put them together and she's going to solve it. And she's going to give everyone answers that they want. Whereas, right. You know, with Willoughby, it's, you, Marianne's just kind of left sobbing, and Eleanor's like kind of got that "told you so" vibe going on. Right.
I think the Miss Jennings response to Colonel Brandon is just kind of this stealth brilliance on Jane Austen's part, because that's what all the readers are doing. Like we make fun of Mrs. Jennings, right? Like, oh, she's so silly, but like all of us are doing that. All of us,
yeah.
So Mrs. Jennings.
We are implicated then as we're reading it and kind of pointing our finger at her and, oh, but all of us have thought of all the things she says and that and trying to figure it out. And I just think one more, even in this early novel, as we've, you know, kind of pointed a little bit of the weaknesses, that is so brilliant and subtle. And like she really is, Jane Austen really is just an absolutely brilliant novelist. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love this little description at the beginning of chapter 14 about Mrs. Jennings was a great wonderer.
Yeah, yeah.
Aren't we all? Yes.
As everyone must be who takes a very lively interest in all the comings and goings of all their acquaintances. And she, I love the next part too. She wondered with little intermission what could be the reason of it.
Yes. She was sure there must be some bad news, of course.
Exactly. Exactly. Something very melancholy must be the matter, she says. And she thinks she knows other people too, because she says, well, I could see it in his face. I just looked at him and I knew what the problem was.
And you know? And we all do this, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we're so certain of our perspective and understanding and interpretation.
Yeah, and well, that's the genius thing about having all these different perspectives too, because she gives us these characters that in some ways do sort of represent or appeal to, I don't know, the baser instincts, the baser ways that we might respond, or the more negative ways that we would respond to something. Because as you said, we all are Mrs. Jennings, and then sometimes she has characters that seem to represent the more noble way we might respond to something. And then most characters are sort of in between. But all those different perspectives, we have to constantly be judging which one, in a sense, which one is the most virtuous. Mm-hmm. So there's that constant exercise of making judgments that the book's demanding of us throughout the whole thing. You know, judging, not just judging whether a character is virtuous, but, you know, judging whether what they're doing is virtuous, whether what they're saying is virtuous. There's all these different little micro judgments, I guess, that we're being forced to do. But I guess that's just the action of reading, right?
Right.
I mean, you write about that in your book, I suppose. You just wrote a whole book about it.
And it's the action of living, right? Because you know, that's, we interpret everything around us all day long. It's another kind of reading.
Do you make, I guess this is, you know, not specific about this book, but on the act of reading itself, do you make a distinction between interpretation and judgment?
Well, I think interpretation comes first. You know, we interpret and then judge, I guess, based on our interpretation. And maybe interpretation is a little bit more or less conscious and aware, or can be less conscious and aware. Well, I guess judgment can be too, but I think judgment is based on interpretation.
So interpretation is more in the realm of the observation, gathering of facts, and then judgment is the deciding what they mean? Or
is interpretation is deciding the meaning of the facts, but then from the meaning we make a judgment, I guess.
Well, an interpretation takes place within the world of a story, right? You're interpreting what's happening based on the terms that are set by the narrative itself. And judgment is something that happens from the outside onto the story.
Do you agree with that, Karen?
Yeah. I'm thinking about the kind of and judgment. I mean, we could agree on, we see certain facts, certain details, and interpret them, and then we can, so for example, in Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth's judgment of Darcy's proposal was to turn it down, you know. Judgment, it doesn't always have to be action, but I think it's the closest thing to the to this action. So interpretation, judgment, action.
We have a we've had kind of an ongoing debate with listeners and other guests who've come on about this, the idea of like asking students to judge characters in books, as opposed to judging an author, say.
Judgment is bad.
So on the one hand, there's the, I mean, maybe a student or a young person doesn't know enough to be able to say, oh, this is a bad book, right? I feel like this is a bad book. And that's their judging the quality of the author. And like, maybe they're not educated or knowledgeable or far enough along in their journey to do that, although they're going to, even if we don't ask them to. But then when it comes to asking students to judge the judgment of a character, where does that come in for you in the teaching process? So you mentioned Elizabeth Bennet. She makes a judgment about Darcy's proposal and how to respond to that. So when you're talking about Pride and Prejudice, or I don't know, I mean, maybe we're not far enough along in this book, but, or maybe we could be looking at Eleanor's response, initial sort of instinctive response to Willoughby.
That's good.
She's making a judgment about Willoughby based on various reasons. But when you're talking about the book with your students, would you talk about, would you ask them or have a discussion that says, do you think she made the right decision, or she should have done that, or how do you approach that concept with students? Now, I realize you're doing this with college students, so we can ask more of them than we can, a seventh grader like the ones that Heidi was trying to read Mansfield Park with, or Emma, Emma. But so anyway, I'm rambling now to give you a chance to think.
I mean, this is what we do with literature. I mean, I don't know if I necessarily use the word judgment.
It came up in the conversation.
I mean, it's just interpretation and analysis, and I think I probably do this a lot just because I want to highlight and sort of make large that this is what reading is, and this is, you know, as I said before, what we also do in life. So yes, let's sit there and dissect Elizabeth and Darcy and the letter and Charlotte. And yes, we have, one of my favorite parts of teaching Pride and Prejudice is talking about what Heidi just brought up about, you know, Charlotte's decision to marry Collins. Like it can be, something that can, you can have a lot of well-supported opinions about. And so, to me, this is one of the great gifts of great literature is that it gives us the opportunity to practice our interpretation skills, our discernment skills, our skills of judgment. We do this a lot.
One way that I will set when I'm teaching to kind of disconnect what students might impose upon a novel that has maybe a different set of terms for how it judges its own characters. Like, for example, Jane Austen. Nowadays, Marianne's conduct with Willoughby, there's no question that that's perfectly appropriate within our society right now. In fact, very, very tame. But obviously, within this society, she is doing something that lacks decorum with Willoughby if they're not engaged secretly, right? And so one way that I'll kind of disconnect that modern imposition upon a novel like this, in which there's a different set of moral terms within the world of the novel than there is within ours, is to ask the student to make judgments based on both. So I'll say, okay, students, like, how... is what Marianne, is her conduct with Willoughby, should she have done that based on kind of the world of dating today? And they'll say, sure, that's fine. Okay. Based on the worlds of interactions between men and women in their time.
That's kind of a low bar. Right?
Exactly. Yes. Which they have. That's their bar. And so they look at a novel like this and don't understand what the big deal is. So I'll say, okay, well, now let's look at it within Jane Austen's world, within Regency England, based on these standards. And maybe that brings in a little bit of a lecture on, given by the teacher, given by me, on these standards, and then say, based on that, should Marianne have done that, right? And then there's a conversation that you can have with your students to get into the world of the novel and then be able to kind of evaluate or make judgments about our own society and the way we've been raised and formed compared to Austen. And I do that with the Iliad. I do it with Shakespeare. I do it with everything I teach. This idea of there are different ways to look at a moral choice within a novel. And then that creates then a whole other conversation on how we make judgments now. And so I think that teaching college, it's so much more sophisticated than some of the students that some of us, you know, are teaching. And so kind of that particular question can help as we're forming our own judgments.
Do you think that's true, that it's more sophisticated teaching college students? I mean, it obviously is in some ways, but...
Well, ideally, yes. No. No, it is. I mean, by the time I'm teaching in an upper level class for English majors, that they're, you know, understanding that we're talking about the world of the novel. And there's a lot of real life, you know, real world application that we can make and parallels we can make. But yes, we're judging the text on the terms of the text.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about, something and now I forgot what I was going to say. I just got a text from my wife saying that the baby's not napping and the 3-year-old has pooped 6 times today and not in the toilet. So.
I take it that's a high number, huh?
Yeah. threw me off there for a minute.
Speaking of real world applications, right?
That's right.
Exactly. I need to give her a chance to go just read some Jane Austen for a while. So we've got for almost an hour here, and I know, Heidi, you have to go pick. Speaking of real world, you have to go pick up your son from school, and Karen, you have family around. So let's turn to some final thoughts here, because as we're going into the last part of book 3, we have this first real, like, you know, we've had hints of drama with Brandon and obviously the father dying before, you know, kind of off stage and so forth. So there's been hints of drama, but we at least have our first hint of, well, maybe it's just melodrama, but something is happening here with Willoughby, and he leaves and he kind of leaves Marianne behind very upset. And so things are starting to kick into high gear here. So what are the questions you're asking as we read these last chapters of volume 1 for next week? Heidi, I'll let you ask that first in case you need to go.
Sure. I think it's simple, right? At this point, I'm wanting to know what's going on with Willoughby and what is going on with, you know, obviously, why did he leave? And then whether or not they're secretly engaged, because the answer to those two questions obviously is a very big conflict of the novel. We have now gone far enough that we have, as you pointed out, actual conflicts within the novel. We're not just doing character development. We are into the plot. And so I'm wondering that, because there's especially the question of the engagement. That, I think, is the focus here.
Why?
Because of the...
I mean, for more than just... Is it more than just plot?
Yeah, that has to do with, as we're just talking about, judgments. If Eleanor is wrong about that, what does that say about her character? If she is right, what does that say about Marianne's? And so that is crucial moving forward. And in some ways more important than what happens with Willoughby, because again, he's definitely not tangential to the plot. He is the plot at this point. But the question is more about Sense and Sensibility than it is at this point who marries whom.
Okay, you can leave now.
Fine. No, I'm just kidding. Thanks, guys. This was great.
Karen, what about you?
Well, I would say, those are the big questions. Another sort of lingering question is, hey, where's Edward? Like, he just kind of been off scene for a while. And then also, I think especially for first-time readers or people new to the world of Austen, like, what is up with this big deal about second attachments? Clearly that's going to play a role, and I do wonder people on Team Marianne think about her belief in the perfect match or the soulmate. Obviously that's going to be developed, and so I love thinking about that and talking about that theme.
Yeah, that was one of those concepts that I had marked down to possibly talk about today, but I mean, we didn't get there, but that's definitely going to be something that having not read this in a long time, that's something that piqued my interest that I'm going to be kind of looking out for to see is that part of the reason why she is so enamored with him and so distraught when he leaves. I mean, it seems like it has to be that maybe she thinks that this is like the soulmate for her or something like that.
Yeah. We'll have to talk about that later for sure.
All right. Well, thank you for being here. Thank you. Heidi, are you still here? No, I think she's gone. Well, thank you, Karen, for joining me and Heidi, and for taking part in these conversations. It's been great having you here, and having your just your background and all the knowledge that you have is really helping open up things. And got some great comments on our Facebook page that with all these listeners who are commenting on it, lots of nice things to say about your participation. So thank you for being here.
Oh, great. Glad to be part of it, and looking forward to next week.
Yes. So again, that we will finish up volume one. So that's chapters, well, actually off the top of my head, I don't remember, but we'll finish volume one. And are all editions divided into three volumes, or is some of them just 45 chapters or whatever? Do you know?
The ones that I have are divided into volumes, but there probably are some. Yeah, there's so many different versions, so I'm going by the volumes. Yeah,
are you going to be doing that, the three volume structure with your edition?
You know, that's a good question, because my publisher will be selecting the edition. You know, based hopefully if there are more than one available by public domain and whatever, I mean, then we'll be using that one. But I haven't gotten that far yet. But it was actually. I realized I need to ask that soon, because I'm marking up my text and thinking, oh, I need to make sure I'm using the same one that will be my publisher will use.
Yeah, you don't want to have to go back and figure out how to mark up all your notes and everything. Well, again, thank you for being here. Thanks to everyone who's been listening. If you want to participate in the conversation, you can head over to Facebook and the Close Reads Facebook groups over there. Lots of good conversation. You can follow us on Instagram and on Twitter as well at Close Reads Pods. And if you have any questions or comments that you want to leave, you can email us at closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. And don't forget that you can head over to classicalu.com/code, enter the code CERCEPODCAST at checkout, and get free access to Classical U through June 29th. All right, with that, for Karen Swallow Pryor and for Heidi White, for all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Happy reading, and we'll talk to you next week.
it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.